From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Joyce Johnson's memoir, Minor Characters, covers the years 1957 to 59 when she and Jack Kerouac were lovers. Her new novel is set in New York's downtown bohemia of the early 60s. Coming up, Joyce Johnson remembers being a woman in a circle of mostly male beat writers and artists. Language is both beautiful and treacherous to David Shields. He is a novelist who has a stutter. Coming up, we talk about Dead Languages, his new semi-autobiographical novel. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of vintage Gilbert and Sullivan recordings, and commentator Eileen Segalov shares her thoughts on loving her mother and hating Mother's Day. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Joyce Johnson met Jack Kerouac in January of 1957 when she was 21. For the next 2 years, they were lovers, although much of that time Kerouac was on the road, while Johnson remained home in New York. In her 1983 memoir, Minor Characters, Johnson wrote about being a woman on the periphery of a circle of male beat writers. The memoir won a National Book Critics Circle Award. Johnson is now a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine and a former editor at Dial Press and Atlantic Monthly Books. At the end of Minor Characters, she briefly describes her life in the years immediately following her relationship with Kerouac. She explains that in her mid-20s, she fell deeply in love and married James Johnson. Soon after that, he died in a motorcycle accident. James Johnson is the model for the character of Tom Murphy in Joyce Johnson's new novel, In the Night Café. Set in the early 60s, the novel is about Joanna Gold, who has left her middle-class background to live a bohemian life, and Tom Murphy, a talented but struggling painter. Like the Johnson marriage, their marriage is ended by a fatal motorcycle accident. I asked Joyce Johnson to read a passage in which Joanna Gold describes the pleasure and danger of riding on the motorcycle with Tom.
I remember hurtling out over the Brooklyn Bridge in astonishing rushes of cold air, the steel beneath our wheels singing its one long high note, and the highways that took us out of the city, all ablaze the farther we went, red, yellow, red, yellow. For a while you could fill your mind up with those colors. Or with the roadbed beneath us, which had to be watched so carefully, all those patches of things that could have done us in, oil slick or sand, spills of gravel, the shiny places that were wet when we came up on them fast. We kept saying we had to buy helmets, but we never did. I was always freezing, trying to warm myself, my breast bruised into you, skidding on the blue nylon of your jacket. I got to know the back of your neck by heart, the places where your hair grew thickest and curled a little. You smell brown, I remember whispering into your ear, when we'd stop for a light in some town in Westchester. I'd close my eyes and hold you even tighter when you speeded us down that narrow path between the lanes of cars. Death Alley, it was called, like the avenue in your old neighborhood. On the roads, I'd see other couples clenched in the same embrace. This was how we looked, too, I'd tell myself, surprised. Daring and fatal. I would never have been the girl on the buddy seat if it hadn't been for you. Motorcycle riders would salute each other, holding their right palms up against the wind. It was always done so solemnly that at first it made me want to laugh. Then I began to think maybe we did all belong to the same thing. A secret society traveling the lanes cars wouldn't dare to enter, coming out in our machines to burn up time. Now it seems crazy that I came to be so unthinking, accepting the danger of those rides the way I accepted the cold. Being like you, I used to feel, instead of like me. Didn't we move out there as if we were one body? I was sure that if we died, we'd die together. But how could we die when we were so alive?
Do you remember feeling that way on a bicycle?
Yeah, I do. I do remember feeling exactly that way. I remember the absolute thrill of those rides and the feeling of being totally located in the moment.
On the other hand, I got the feeling that you felt like you didn't really belong on a motorcycle.
Well, it was something I never would have I never would have done if I hadn't been married to the man I was married to, who was a person who lived his life in terms of taking risks. I'm a more cautious person by nature.
Well, I like that line in there about this is what I'd call being like you instead of being like me.
Yeah.
Was that a hard thing to figure out when you were very close with someone who was really different from you? What instincts were really his and which were yours? And which should you follow?
Well, you know, like a lot of young women, I craved adventure. And And in a way, knowing certain men brought me close to certain kinds of adventures. For example, when I knew Kerouac, I could never, you know, I was not a person who could myself at that time go on the road, but I felt close to that experience hearing Kerouac talk about it and write about it too. I always wanted to go on the road with him. And in a sense, the motorcycle was a kind of on the road experience for me.
Well, this is reminding me of something that you'd said in an interview several years ago after Minor Characters, when I interviewed you, and this really stuck with me. You said that men during that period in the 50s and early 60s had adventures. And for women, their female counterparts, the adventures were frequently having relationships with the men who had adventures.
That's true. That's true. And I think it's still true to some extent.
Did you ever want those adventures for yourself? Did you ever consider going on the road?
I fantasize about those adventures, but as I say, I was a cautious person. I was sort of aware of the risks, you know, in my own way, as a very young woman living in the village and hanging out in the circles, I hung out and I took certain risks, certainly a lot of emotional risks. I think those were the kinds of risks I took.
Well, you also had a lot of lovers, at least I assume that from the novel. You know, in The Night Cafe, the character says it was 1962. In 3 years, I'd had 14 lovers. Sex was really an adventure and was, in its own way, for women as risky as going out on the road. There were a lot of hazards involved.
There were a lot of hazards involved. And in the days before, you know, really good birth control, it was a little bit like Russian roulette.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to have an abortion, didn't you?
That's right. That's right.
Was it dangerous?
Yes. Well, it was. I was lucky because I went to a real doctor. But the surrounding circumstances, were very kind of scary and sleazy. But it turned out okay.
Joyce Johnson is my guest, and her new novel is called In the Night Cafe. Tom, the painter in this new novel, and Jack Kerouac, who you were very close to for about a year, were both artists, and. The main woman character in your new novel and yourself in your memoir about your time with Kerouac both felt that they hadn't found themselves yet, that they hadn't found their work yet, that they were with a man who had a very strong sense of his work, but that the woman hadn't found hers. When you were experiencing that, was that very hard to go through, of being with someone who was so sure of their work and being not sure you'd found yours?
It was a hard thing to go through, and it had something to do with the time that I found myself in. I think, you know, 6 or 7 years later, things began to change very much for women. But in 62, just as it had been in the late 1950s, there really wasn't much interest or support when it came to women themselves wanting to produce art. Nobody took it seriously. Nobody was very interested. It was a very kind of lonely enterprise. In my own case, I did publish a first novel when I was very young, when I was 26 years old. This was in 1962, and this was just before I met my first husband, and it was really a sense of publishing into a terrible void. I remember I remember one review that I got, which is sort of typical the kinds of reviews that a young woman would get in those days if she managed to publish something. There was a person in the Herald Tribune called Talia Farrow Boatwright who referred to me in the review as a concise little miss.
Oh, horrible. Well, was Jack Kerouac or your first husband supportive of your writing?
Both were actually very supportive of me. Both encouraged me to work, and what I was really struggling with was the feeling of a kind of larger disinterest in what I was doing.
You know, something I really love about your books is that they're stories that prove that you ultimately found your calling in writing. You know, they're stories in which the woman is typing to make a living, supporting these artists, wondering, like, will she ever find her own work? And you do, and the novel and the memoir that describes this prove it. Well, I just find that very exciting.
Well, of course, while you're very engaged in living, you're also accumulating things that you may later write about.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't, you know, those times weren't wasted.
In a way, I think you loved two self-destructive artists. I mean, the character of Tom, who's based on your husband, comes off as reasonably self-destructive, and Kerouac certainly had his self-destructive instincts. Do you agree with that?
Yes. I didn't love them because they were self-destructive.
Mm-hmm. But I think that makes a relationship a lot more problematic.
But it does make things. It was very. Both relationships were very intense. But I wanted to. I hoped. I believed that somehow everything would work out. That love would sort of save the day. That what these people needed was to be loved, and then that would overcome their histories. But people can't overcome their histories very well most of the time.
I was wondering if even when they were at their most self-destructive and most selfish, if one of the things that would often keep you going would be their work, seeing something really extraordinary in their work that you knew came from them and that you'd continue loving in them no matter what they were going through.
I think that's very true. I did feel that. I felt there was a connection to this intense, painful feeling that they had and what came out in their work. Certainly in Kerouac's work, over and over again, one is aware of his pain and of his sense of mortality and of how short life is, and that's what gives it his work its special quality. It's all infused with that sense. And I had somewhat the same sense about my husband's paintings, which were all done in a kind of frenzy. They'd be done very quickly. They'd work or they wouldn't work. If they worked, they remained on the wall. If they didn't work, they went on the floor. And being a writer, and of actually a very slow, painstaking writer, I was really jealous in a way of seeing those big swashes of paint go across the canvas and something being there so quickly.
It's funny to me, when you were living a very bohemian life, you were supporting yourself and frequently supporting the men who you lived with by typing, by working as a secretary in various places.
That's right, yeah.
As your main character does in your novel In the Night Cafe. There's a passage I'd really like for you to read about that.
Okay, just a second. In those days, I was a crackerjack typist, 100 WPM. I typed envelopes, theses, just about everything. I'd stick cards up all over the village. Speed of light satisfaction. No job too big or too small. If I ran out of clients, I'd be a Kelly girl and go around to various offices. I didn't mind that too much because it was interesting to work in different parts of the city. I'd eat a tuna fish sandwich at my desk and walk around in my lunch hour learning about places like Varick Street and Coenties Slip. I could usually type faster than any of the other secretaries, and sometimes they'd ask me to stay on permanently. I'd say no, I didn't want a regular job. It was because of the acting. I always had to keep leave an opening for it. But also, I was afraid offices would get me and I wouldn't be free anymore. I'd somehow be stuck in a role I'd never meant to choose, an office girl who wore nylons all through the hot weather and a dictation pad on her knee, when I wanted so much more for myself, when my real life hadn't even started. As a Kelly girl, I saw things I didn't like in other people's offices, tyrannies, cruelties. But the beauty of being a Kelly girl was that none of that had to do with me. I could walk out and go to acting class, hang out with artists at the Cedar. I could tell Kelly girls to send me to a different job. I was temporary. I had no stake in any office.
Did you do a lot of that yourself?
I did some of that. I actually had a series of fairly steady jobs It worked better in this novel to make Joanna an office temporary.
Well, I remember in Jack Kerouac's letters, he used to refer to you as my little secretary in long black stockings.
That's true.
And also, you had when you were in your early 20s, you had been offered an editorial assistant position, a promotion from your secretarial position at a publishing company. But you turned that down because Kerouac had just invited you to join him in Mexico.
That's right. I thought that was my opportunity to go on the road. I was ready.
And what happened?
Well, he went to Mexico City and became ill there, and there was an earthquake. And as very often happened on Jack's trips, he would go to a place with full of hope, and then the place would suddenly accumulate bad vibes, and he'd feel that he'd have to leave. And that's exactly what happened. So instead of staying in Mexico City, he sent me a letter that he was on his way to New York. And so he came up to New York.
So you never made it on the road with him?
I never made it on the road with him.
What about that job offer? What happened with that?
I had turned that offer down and said, no, really, my plans have changed. I'm going to meet Jack Kerouac in Mexico City, and I left that job. But I had just sold my first novel and gotten half the advance, which was $500, which in 1957 was actually an enormous sum. I could imagine living on that for several months, and I did, in fact.
Did you ever have any regrets about turning down that job?
No, I don't think so. No.
Kerouac, when you were with him, had all these road experiences to write about, and you were living with him at the time when On the Road was published. Did you ever say to yourself, well, what will I have to write about? What big experiences will I have?
Yes, of course I would think about that. But I was a different kind of writer than Jack. And one of my great models actually was Henry James, because I was always very interested in relationships and the nuances of relationships. And I knew that that would be my subject.
Did that ever feel like an obsolete kind of writing when people were doing, you know, bop prosody?
No, I don't. I think that subject matter is always important.
Well, I agree, but I was wondering if you were convinced of that at the time.
Well, bop prosody was something I admired very much, but knew I couldn't do myself. It wasn't me. I had a pretty distinct sense of what it was that I did, and I felt that ultimately I would do it very well, and you know, if I just kept at it.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your writing, but first we'll take a short break. Joyce Johnson is my guest. Her new novel is called In the Night Cafe. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Joyce Johnson. Her memoir, Minor Characters, was about the time she and Jack Kerouac were lovers. Her new novel is called In the Night Cafe. Johnson is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine. Let me ask you about another theme in your new novel, and that is the theme of men who abandon their wife and children. The husband in this book is a victim of that. His father left him when he was born, basically.
Right.
And then the husband, in his first marriage, does the same thing. He walks out on his son. And then the main character, the woman in this novel, later marries another man who walks out on their child. As a matter of fact, before we discuss this theme, let me ask you to read a paragraph about this marriage.
Mikkel's studio seemed wonderfully Parisian to me until after Nikki was born. It was an open 17th century attic. Mikkel wouldn't spoil it by putting up a wall. It had a romantic little balcony. You could step right out onto it and see chimneys and silver flashes of the Seine between rooftops. But there was no running water. Buckets had to be carried from a tap 3 flights down. I used to think if we'd had a wall or two or American plumbing, our marriage might have lasted longer. Mikkel greatly admired Nikki, but he left him entirely to me. The soft spot on babies' heads alarmed him. He'd pick Nikki up as if he were made of glass.
Was this an incapability of many men that you knew, the incapability of really being fathers?
At that time, I think it was very sort of difficult for many men to be fathers. There's much more sort of consciousness of the father's role, I think, right now, which is a very, very good, healthy thing. But still, there are fathers who are absent in one way or another. I teach an autobiography class at Columbia, and the whole theme of the absent father comes up over and over again in the work of my students, many of whom are, you know, products of broken marriages, or the fathers are present but absent in some way, unreachable, not there in some way for their children. And actually, that whole theme of absent fathers is the real organizing principle of this novel, which you guessed very accurately.
Did you accept this in the men that you knew, in a sense of, well, men are like that, they can't be tied down, and they don't want to be part of a family?
Well, I had had a very different experience as a child. My father was there and was a fairly devoted father. what I became aware of was that for men like Tom Murphy in my novel, who'd been abandoned by their own fathers, the ramifications carried over not only into their lives and the lives of their children, but into the lives of the women they married and so on. It sort of was a thing that ran through generations.
As a writer, you keep going back to the 1950s and early 1960s. Do you feel that that is your period?
It was a period that I found intensely rich and interesting and exciting and dramatic. It was certainly the most dramatic period of my life. So I have gone back to it in two books. I don't know that I will continue this in the future.
Who are you still in touch with from that period in your life?
Mainly Hetty Jones.
Who you dedicate your new novel to.
Who I dedicate my new novel to.
And you knew her at the time when she married Leroy Jones.
That's correct, yes.
Do you think of her as having had a lot of similar experiences with you, as you? In other words, becoming romantically involved with a man who was, a rising star in the bohemian scene and having your work take a back seat to it.
Yes, we've had somewhat parallel experiences. Right now in the Village Voice Literary Supplement, there is, I think, a very sort of misguided article on Beat Women, which mentions me and also mentions Hetty. And it's that sort of kind of boring perception, writing Beat Women off as passive. What the writer, Alex Kate Shulman, doesn't really understand is that at the time, which was the late 50s and early 60s, the really big struggle for young women was just getting away from home, mm-hmm. Getting out in the world, getting a place to live, having some sexual experience, becoming self-supporting. All those things were new then for women to do. Now we sort of expect our young women to do all those things. But then, not only wasn't expected, it was also censured by families and by society. It was very, very tough, and it was such a struggle to do that much that there wasn't time, in a way, to transform relationships with men. It wasn't the moment when we could even think about that, and we did sort of forge a path for women who came after us by having some kind of independent life. We viewed ourselves as independent. I mean, we often, of course, not only took care of ourselves but of the men we were involved with.
Writer and editor Joyce Johnson is my guest. You have a recent article in the January edition of Fame magazine. It was about going back to Kerouac's hometown where a memorial in his honor was being unveiled. I think at this memorial gathering, there were several of Kerouac's former wives.
That's true, yes.
What's it like when you all get together? I mean, you and he weren't married, but had a fairly long relationship.
Well, the people at the gathering were Edie Parker, who was his first wife, and I also got to know Jack's daughter Jan pretty mm-hmm. well through going to that thing at Lowell, and we're all very, very friendly with each other, and Edie and I have talked a lot over the years and swapped experiences and gotten to increased our own understanding of the kind of person Jack was. Jack's third wife, however, Stella Kerouac, who is the executor of his estate, has remained aloof from everybody else, and not only ex-wives and girlfriends, but friends of Jack's, and that remained true during the time that everybody was at Lowell.
So has that made it hard to get access to certain letters of his or other personal documents that someone would consider using in writing a memoir about him or a biography?
Well, Stella Kerouac's position is that she doesn't want anything more by Jack Kerouac published during her lifetime, and I don't know quite what the reason for that is, but it makes it enormously difficult, I think, for say, biographers to do a really authoritative job because they can't quote from any of Jack's letters. He was a wonderful letter writer, and I myself had many letters from him. When I came to write my memoir, Minor Characters, I discovered that I was not going to be allowed to quote from any of these letters, which I'd had in my possession for years and years.
Do you think it's selfish to do that?
I think it's selfish. I think it's certainly not what Kerouac would have wished. Kerouac was a writer who was very kind of conscious of his place in history and who very carefully kept up his archives. I mean, his life may have been very chaotic, but he saved all kinds of writings and letters and so on. And I wonder what's happened to those archives. Those archives may very well include some very interesting unpublished manuscripts, but certainly his letters are quite remarkable and would be worth publishing, would be valuable reading for many people.
You've been an editor for many years now.
That's right.
How did you become an editor?
I went to work after I got out of Barnard College, where I'd been an English major, and being an English major, I wanted to get into publishing. My first jobs were in a couple of literary agencies, but then I began to work in publishing houses. In those days, a young woman could be a secretary practically forever. Things have really changed. But as a secretary, you could allow yourself to be exploited and take manuscripts home and do some editing without being called editor. So finally, I sort of worked my way up. And when I was at William Morrow & Company, I actually began to acquire books because friends of mine were writing some interesting books. And so I finally said, well, you know, why don't you call me an editor since that's what I'm doing? And they agreed to. And then I became a real editor after that. And the editing was very absorbing and satisfying work for me, although for many years that I was editing, I did no writing of my own.
When you were with Kerouac at the time that he was becoming famous, you had seen some publishers reject his work because they didn't really understand it. Did that make you a more committed editor yourself, more committed to trying to penetrate things that on first reading might seem strange to you?
Yes, I was very determined to try to see that certain works that other publishers might consider unacceptable got into print. During the late 60s and the 70s, I was very concerned with publishing books on civil rights. I published Abby Hoffman's first book, Revolution for the Hell of It, and a whole lot of other stuff of that kind.
You know, at the end of both Minor Characters and your new novel In the Night Cafe, I was left with this question: will this woman ever find the same kind of passion and commitment that she's found in the story that I've just read? And I guess I want to ask you that question because I've left both of these books set in the 50s and 60s thinking, well, is that it? Is that the height of passion in the life?
For me, I think it certainly was, as my life worked out. I've gone on to actually, you know, find satisfaction in other things, with my relationship with my son, with you know, long lasting good friendships with people, and also, of course, in my relationship with my work, which is my real work, which is writing, which has come to take a larger and larger place in my life. In the last few years, for the first time, I've been able to become a full-time writer, and that feels very good to me.
Do you regret that there isn't that same level of passion now, or do you just accept that that's the way it is?
I just accept that that's the way it is. No one goes on into another state of being, I guess.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joyce Johnson's new novel, In the Night Cafe, is published by E.P. Dutton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Gregory Hoblit. He's won several Emmys for his work as producer and director of the TV shows Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman. Hoblit is the producer-director of the made-for-TV movie Roe vs. Wade, which will be shown on NBC this Monday night. It stars Holly Hunter and Amy Madigan. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Shields is all too aware of what he calls the oppressive power of words. Like the main character in his new novel, Shields has a stutter. He's come to think of his stutter as representing the difficulty of all communication. Coming up, we talk with Shields about his new book, Dead Languages. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of vintage recordings from Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. And guest commentator Eileen Segalov has some thoughts about Mother's Day that you'll never see expressed on a Mother's Day card. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The situation in Panama took a sharp turn for the worse today. Paramilitary groups attacked opposition presidential candidate Guillermo Ondara and his two vice presidential running mates. More from NPR's Tom Jelton in Panama City.
The attack on Ondara and his two vice presidential candidates, Billy Ford and Ricardo Arias Calderon, came as they were leading a rally at a downtown park here this afternoon. A group of thugs in T-shirts, identifying them as members of General Manuel Noriega's so-called Dignity Battalions, arrived at the rally. According to opposition leaders, soldiers on duty made no effort to protect the candidates and let the thugs attack. All three were beaten on the head and body. Billy Ford was injured most seriously, according to opposition leaders. He was taken from the scene by police and is currently in detention at an unknown location. Arias Calderon is in hiding. Ondara was treated for a head wound at a local hospital and released. The Noriega regime has offered no explanation as yet for the incident. In Panama City, I'm Tom Jelton.
The White House today condemned the violence in Panama City. New Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said President Bush called several Latin American leaders today to discuss the latest developments. Soviet officials said today that negotiations on nuclear arms reductions will resume in mid-June in Geneva. Foreign Ministry spokesman Gennady Gerasimov said the agreement was reached during the first day of talks between Secretary of State James Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze in Moscow. The two officials met for almost 3 hours today to discuss a number of topics, including regional issues, arms control, and human rights. In Iran, the parliamentary speaker, Hashemi Rafsanjani, has withdrawn remarks in which he incited Palestinians to murder Westerners and to commit acts of terrorism. Mike Theodulu has details.
Rafsanjani said he did not advise killing innocent people, and his remarks have been misinterpreted. What he meant, he said, was that Israeli oppression of Palestinians would naturally lead to violent reactions. His remarks last week, in which he called upon Palestinians to murder Westerners and to commit acts of terrorism, were denounced not only by the West, but also by the PLO, which told him it did not need his poisoned advice. Rafsanjani is a front-runner in August presidential elections. His comments last Friday were read in the West as a kind of perverted election manifesto designed to win the support of Iranian hardliners. There must have been pressure from some powerful source for Rafsanjani's retraction today. Tomorrow, a senior Soviet economic team is due in Tehran to prepare for Rafsanjani's visit to Moscow next month. The purpose of his visit is to buy arms. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
It was Independence Day in Israel today, but while some Israelis celebrated in parks and on beaches, the bloodshed continued in the occupied territories. Israeli troops shot and killed two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in clashes that occurred despite a curfew that kept at home more than half the 1.7 million Palestinians living in the occupied territories. At least four people were killed and 14 were wounded today during heavy shelling in Beirut. The attacks came as Arab League peacemakers headed for the city on a mission to end 8 weeks of bloodshed that has killed at least 350 people. Syria's Muslim militia allies have vowed to keep shelling Christian ports until observers arrive. The League has said the peacekeepers will not be sent in before a ceasefire takes hold. The Bush administration said today that it opposes the PLO's application for membership in UNESCO. A State Department spokesman said membership in the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization is limited to states and that the PLO does not qualify. The administration opposes the PLO's application to the World Health Organization on the same grounds. Meanwhile, in Geneva, the WHO put off a decision on the PLO's application for 48 hours. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 3 points, closing at 2374.45. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. For over a century, the operettas of Gilbert and Sullivan have been almost as popular in this country as in England. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of a series of historical Gilbert and Sullivan recordings, which he says remain the very models for all these works.
I am the very model of a modern major general. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical.
After Richard Doyley Carte produced Gilbert and Sullivan's Trial by Jury in 1875, he decided to start a company that would put on every new work by this celebrated team. 12 full-length operettas followed, and they've been performed regularly ever since, not only by Doyley Carte's company in England, but by professional and amateur groups all over the world, even in America. I was in my junior high school production of The Mikado. I played Coco, the Lord High Executioner of Titipu, and I've been in love with GNS ever since. The Gilbert and Sullivan craze in this country began over a century ago. In fact, The Pirates of Penzance had its world premiere not in London, but in New York on New Year's Eve, 1879. The first complete Doyley Carte recordings started to appear before 1920. Some of the performers on them began their careers under the supervision of Gilbert and Sullivan themselves. Performers like the great comedian Sir Henry Lytton, who spent 50 years with the company. Here he is on the 1927 recording of The Gondoliers, just issued by Arabesque. He's singing the patter song of the Duke of Plaza Toro, that celebrated hero who led his regiment from behind.
In enterprise of martial kind, when there was any fighting, he led his regiment from behind, he found it less exciting. But when away his regiment ran, his place was in the Fordo, and celebrated, cultivated, underrated nobleman, the Duke of Plaza Fordo.
In the first and foremost fight, ha-ha, you always found that night, ha-ha, and celebrated, cultivated, underrated nobleman, the Duke of Plaza Fordo.
When to evade destruction's hand or hide, they all proceeded. No soldier in that gallant band hit half as well as he did. He lay concealed throughout the war and so preserved his Goro, an unaffected, undetectable, connected warrior, the Duke of Plaza Toro.
GNS performances have certainly declined from their early brilliance. The music making on these old recordings is tighter and livelier. The tempos have an astonishing speed and buoyancy. The diction itself is breathtaking. Listen to George Baker as the lovesick and sleepless Lord Chancellor in Iolanthe. Baker kept recording the major GNS comic roles until he was nearly 78, but was never in Doyley Carte's company, nor ever appeared in a professional GNS production.
When you're lying awake with a dismal headache and repose is taboo by anxiety, I conceive you may use any language you choose to indulge in without impropriety. For your brain is on fire, the bedclothes conspire of usual slumber to plunder you. First your counterpane goes and uncovers your toes and your sheet slips demurely from under you. In the blanketing tickles you feel like mixed pickles, so terribly sharp is the pricking. And you're hot and you're cross and you tumble and toss till there's nothing twixt you and the ticking. And the bedclothes all creep to the ground in a heap and you pick them all up in a tangle. Next your pillow resigns and politely declines, so remain at its usual angle. Will you get some repose in the form of a dose with hot eyeballs and head ever aching? But your slumbering teams are such horrible dreams that you'd very much better be waking. For your dream you are crossing the channel and tossing about in a steamer from Harwich, which is something between a large bathing machine and a very small second-class carriage. And you're giving a treat, penny, ice and cold meat to a party of friends and relations. They're a ravenous horde and they all came on board at Sloane Square and South Kensington stations. And
the timing is as dazzling as the satire is timeless. Corruption, cowardice, pretension, and self-love are among the objects of Gilbert's droll humor and tingling barbs. One number in the Mikado goes, A should die in misery, that is, assuming I am B. In Princess Ida, Gilbert even parodied himself. Sullivan's music tackles and explodes the clichés of 19th century opera and music hall. But it's also exhilarating in itself, irresistibly pretty, and even deeply touching, as in Iolanthe, where love can be a matter of life and death, and some human feelings are taken with surprising seriousness, even by fairies.
Yeah.
That was Nellie Briarcliffe as the doomed Iolanthe. Other notable performers include the delicious Winifred Lawson, Bertha Lewis, and Martin Green, the most famous Gilbert and Sullivan star of the century, as Coco, Green's first complete recording in a leading role. An added treat on the new CDs of Gondoliers and Iolanthe are selections even more historic than the complete operas themselves, some of the earliest G&S recordings ever made. Here's one made in 1902 of the Mikado explaining his humane system of justice. It's sung by Richard Temple, who in 1885 actually created the role of that philanthropic potentate.
My object all sublime, I shall achieve in time, to let the punishment be the crime, the punishment be the crime, and take each slip of pen, unwillingly represent a source of innocent merriment, of innocent merriment.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a series of historic Gilbert and Sullivan recordings featuring the Doyle Cart Opera Company on the Arabesque label. This is Fresh Air. Jeremy Zorn, the protagonist in David Shields' new novel, is a stutterer. So is Shields. On the first page of Shields' novel, Dead Languages, Jeremy says, "We all choose a calling that's the most radical contradiction of ourselves." Shields says that Jeremy's words describe his own choice to become a writer.
I think there's something about the relationship between stuttering and writing. They're both situations in which words have a kind of violent, ecstatic poetry to them. And so I think that much of the book to me is about the connection between stuttering and writing, that in both cases you're simultaneously loving but also hating the oppressive power that words can have upon your life.
You've written that when you were in college and going to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, that you'd spend part of the day in the writing workshop building and then another part of the day in the speech therapy building.
Right.
Was your speech therapist and were your teachers at the Writers' Workshop aware of each other?
I think people at the Iowa Speech and Hearing Clinic, of course, knew that I was a graduate student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but I sort of kept it relatively secret, I think, from the workshop that I was a patient in the Iowa Speech and Hearing Clinic. But I think clearly the novel was born there. I was just quite fascinated and at times, I suppose, depressed by this sort of hilarious contradiction that in both places, these four-story, and still are, I suppose, these four-story brick buildings, and both seem to be sort of houses of language, places in which you concentrate it on language to a certain extent to the exclusion of life. You're trying to figure out your life through words. And I was just struck by, on the one hand, I was trying to use language beautifully and poetically and sort of in a sort of pleasurable way. And in the other building, I was just trying to say cat correctly. And so there was a sort of, on the one hand, I felt like I was about 6 years old, and on the other hand, I felt like I was, you know, a sort of would-be writer. So that contradiction that between being a sophisticated user of language and a really remedial user of language struck me as two parts of my own soul that I've always struggled with and been fascinated by, and somehow wanted to write a novel that expressed that contradiction.
Let me ask you to read an excerpt of your novel, and this is a passage that really directly confronts how it makes you feel about language when you stutter.
This is from the beginning of chapter 6. I had gotten it into my head that because my interlocutor never knew what I was going to say, and once I said it, he never understood exactly what I meant, it was incumbent upon me to underscore the impossibility of human communication by stuttering. I actually believed that. I thought it was my duty to insert into every conversation the image of its own absurdity. Worse than that, I came to think all fluent speech was, quote, fascistic, a word I had learned from mother, was an assertion of authority in the one enterprise in which any assertion of authority struck me as ludicrous.
I think as a writer, you've been able to turn stuttering into something of a metaphor.
That was certainly my intention. What do you think it's a metaphor for you? Or I guess that's something I should answer.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that.
Well, to me, it's really a metaphor for human communication generally. Everyone in the book, virtually every character from major characters to minor characters, has what I would call a kind of disguised stutter. And so much of what the book is about is how hard it is to communicate your true self by speaking or through language. And I think what Jeremy sort of slowly realizes in the course of the book is that he's not the only person who stutters. I mean, he has the sort of stupidity to actually dramatize it by stuttering badly, but that everyone in the book and virtually everyone in life, by virtue of being human, has trouble using language to communicate their true self. And I think once you realize that, you start giving yourself a slightly less hard time and start to understand how difficult things are for virtually everyone to use language in a completely communicative way. And so to me, stuttering really becomes a kind of metaphor for really the difficulty of human communication generally.
Do you have words that are trouble spots for you, particular sounds?
Uh-huh. Primarily, words starting with vowels seem to be almost exclusively the words that I tend to have trouble on.
Now, does that have any carryover in your writing?
Well, I think that it does, actually. I mean, I think I tend to love sound much more than most writers. I'm sure you're aware of sort of the contemporary vogue of minimalism, which thankfully is sort of slowly coming to a kind of grinding halt now, but minimalism tends not to pay much attention to the sound of words, tends not to be written in a very dramatic, loud-voiced way. And I, as a stutterer, feel a tremendous burden when writing to make language really fly, to make the language really take off as a sound system. And so I think it really has had a huge effect on the kind of writing that I like to read and the kind of writing that I like to try to write. Specifically, I try to write in which the language really takes quite high precedence and specifically has a kind of poetical stuttering about it. I mean, most of the sentences in the book have a kind of buried stutter to them, and that's quite intentional.
When your new book was published, did you have to decide whether or not you were going to do interviews? I don't know how self-conscious you still are about stuttering.
Uh-huh.
And I always think, gosh, you know, on radio, all you have is your voice. You know, it's like
right.
All people know about you is the way your voice sounds. And
Sometimes
that's to your advantage, and sometimes it's to your disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you had decided to be self-conscious about that, not to worry about that. Like, what, do you know what I mean? Like, what your attitude was going to be about...
Well, it's a very good question. I think the main thing for me is that it just seems like simply good practice. I've been spending a good portion of the last few weeks giving readings in New York and Boston and Seattle and sort of traveling about the country giving readings, and that's, you know, a true test in which I'm just sort of reading aloud from the book and tend to, in fact, stutter more much more dramatically there than when speaking. And so, you know, it just seems to me that, you know, there are sort of two approaches. One, just simply never go out of the house, you know, and don't, you know, talk. But that just seems to, in fact, kind of exacerbate the stutter. And instead, I'm a full-time teacher of creative writing. And I just think the more I've gone out and spoken, the better control I have over my speech, as opposed to half a dozen years ago, in which I simply used every excuse I could to avoid speaking in public, didn't give readings, would have students read passages in class, and all these kind of crutches I would rely on. And the more I've done things like give readings or show up on radio or teach in a class and don't avoid speaking a lot, kind of hard to teach without speaking, I just feel like it's simply reduced a lot of the anxiety I felt and has simply made me a better speaker and a better teacher and just a more, you know, communicative person, I suppose, or something like that. I just think it's good for my speech to not avoid situations and simply try to gain control over them and speak well in them.
David Shield's new novel, Dead Languages, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Cherry.
What kind of coverage do you have today from Panama?
From Panama, we'll be hearing what's happening down there since the election. Also, some thoughts here about just what it is exactly that the U.S. has against General Noriega and just how important the Panama Canal is to the U.S. At this date. We'll also be hearing from two whistleblowers, people who were in Washington, D.C. this week to receive prizes for following their consciences and going against their supervisors because they felt things were amiss in the places where they worked. And also, we'll be hearing about a man who's been campaigning for a constitutional amendment first proposed 200 years ago. He still wants to see it adopted.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday, Americans will buy and give approximately 15 million bouquets of flowers and 200 million greeting cards. We'll make more reservations to dine out at restaurants than on any other day of the year. Guest commentator Eileen Segalov has tried all of the above and has these thoughts on how to negotiate Mother's Day.
Lately, I've noticed people weeping in the aisles at their local drugstore. You see, they're in the greeting card section, soaking in the sentiment of Mother's Day cards, searching for the one that most fits their own sweet flesh and blood. I'm a make-your-own-card kid, probably because I got so much fanfare in elementary school from my construction paper carts, overflowing with doilies, glitter, and papier-mâché carnations. My mom loved them, still has them. In the old days, way before I had any money of my own, I'd search through Mom's gift drawer looking for something to give her for Mother's Day. It was filled with all kinds of odd items she'd buy, just in case one of my teachers got married or pregnant. There was always a slew of hankies, personalized hankies. She always bought them on sale, so most of the letters were Y's, K's, or W's. One time I cut a fancy W off and then sewed it back on, upside down, creating a makeshift M for Mom. I slipped it onto her Mother's Day breakfast tray, and even though the sunny-side-up egg spilled all over, Mom daintily retrieved the hanky and dabbed the tears off her cheeks. It's not so simple anymore. Yesterday I received a brightly colored catalog in the mail. This one had a flowery red arrow on the cover, leading me into the gifts for Mom section. No bathrobes or slippers here. Instead, I was told to buy Mom some padded satin hangers and matching shoe shapers, a Water Whiz indoor hose, an aqua mask for sinus headaches, a personalized TV Guide book cover with Mom written in 22-karat gold, and a glow-in-the-dark egg white egg yolk separator. Naturally, the hammock on the last page was highlighted in red, white, and blue for Father's Day. Mom still isn't supposed to be seen lying down. Mother's Day was made official by Woodrow Wilson's signature in 1914. It was inspired by an anxiety-ridden daughter, who wished she and her mom had gotten along better. Before the daughter could make everything all right, her mother died, and a holiday was born. And what a holiday it is, moving every kind of person, from the most cynical to the most sentimental, to doing something special for Mom, even if they haven't spoken to her since last May. Mother's Day makes people guilty. I feel guilty. You see, last Mother's Day, I promised I'd take my mom to lunch and then to a museum. Somehow, we never got it together, even though we live in the same town. But Mom hasn't forgotten. So this year, I swear, it'll be two museums. And of course, I'll buy her the obligatory bouquet. But we won't be going to a restaurant for dinner. As Mom says, they sling it to you. It's too much food, and you really can't enjoy it. And she complains about how your eyes and nose tear from inhaling a room full of pungent pink carnation corsages. When it comes down to it, my mom really rather receive a handmade card filled with some heartfelt message and a promise for an outing that may never happen. You see, Mom knows it's a thought that counts.
Eileen Segalov is an artist and writer who tries to be a good daughter. She lives and works in Los Angeles. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, we meet composer and saxophonist Kurt Hoffman of The Ordinaires. The band has been described as sounding like a shopping binge at a musical Kmart. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new comeback albums from Phoebe Snow, Dion, and Donny Osmond. And guest film critic Stuart Kluwans reviews the new comedy, How to Get Ahead in Advertising. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Fred Landrell. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.